This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, the socialist winner of a Seattle City Council seat says the left needs to relearn grassroots organizing. Private corporations are deeply involved in domestic spying on nonprofit groups. And Dr. Cornel West at the Drone Summit.
But first, Dwayne Buck has spent 15 years on death row for a 1997 murder in Houston, Harris County, Texas. Thousands of people from all walks of life have now joined in demanding that Mr. Buck be spared the death penalty because of the blatantly racist way it was imposed. We spoke with Christina Swarns, Director of Criminal Justice Practice at the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund.
There's a long history of racial discrimination in Harris County. But what happened in Dwayne Buck's particular case was that at the sentencing portion of the proceeding, where the decision had to be made as to whether or not he would be sentenced to the death penalty or life imprisonment, testimony was elicited by the trial prosecutor from a psychologist indicating that Mr. Buck was more likely to be dangerous in the future because he is black. Now, under Texas law, the only way you can be sentenced to death is if the jury finds that you are likely to be a future danger. This is a case where there wasn't a lot of evidence to speak to that question. Mr. Buck does not have any prior felony convictions of violence, so it looks like in this case, the state simply replaced real evidence with stereotype and really inflammatory and offensive testimony linking race to dangerousness.
So this consultant basically testified that Mr. Buck had a predisposition to commit murder because he was black.
That's absolutely right.
Was this the kind of evidence that the prosecution in that county had a habit of bringing?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, it was used in multiple cases, not only in Harris County, but in other counties across Texas, all presented through this one expert witness, because as you can imagine, there aren't a lot of legitimate psychological experts that will testify to something this false and inflammatory. What happened was that one of the other cases was appealed to the United States Supreme Court, and the Attorney General at that time, who was John Cornyn, who is now the United States Senator for Texas, looked at this testimony, and he recognized that it was unconstitutional, improper, and just absolutely wrong for the state of Texas to base death sentences on this. He promised that for six death sentence prisoners who had that testimony presented against them, his office would admit error and make sure that they got fair sentencing. They did that as to every other of the six death sentence prisoners except Mr. Buck. For reasons they have not explained, they have reversed course and pursued Mr. Buck's execution.
So the defense had every reason to believe that this kind of conduct was behind us.
Yeah, that's right. Mr. Buck had proceeded relying on the promise that had been made by the state of Texas with the belief that although an error had been made, it would be acknowledged and corrected by the state of Texas, as it had been in each of these other five cases. And for no reason at all, the state just reneged on that promise and is actively pursuing his execution.
And now we've seen a groundswell of support for the defense from many quarters.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is really just a case that speaks to fundamental qualities of our country, of things that are really fundamental to our society. People should not be executed based on their race or any other immutable characteristic that has nothing to do with sentencing. As a result, we've seen former prosecutors. We have seen evangelical Christians. We have a former Texas governor who has presided over multiple executions, all speaking out on behalf of Mr. Buck. And I think that's because all of us understand that if people can be condemned and executed based on this kind of testimony, none of us are safe.
Let's talk about the history of institutional racism, especially in capital cases in Harris County.
Yes. Well, there's a lot there. What we presented in our petition was, first, of course, the evidence of what happened in this case. Second, we had a statistician review cases like Mr. Buck's that were prosecuted around the time the Mr. Buck's case went to trial. And what he found was that for offenders whose cases were similar to Mr. Buck's, the Harris County District Attorney's Office was three times more likely to seek the death penalty for African-American defendants than they were for white defendants, and that Harris County juries were twice as likely to impose death sentences on African-Americans like Mr. Buck than they were on similar white offenders. You know, that is consistent with what we have seen overall. Harris County and Texas has always, throughout the history of the death penalty in Texas, disproportionately capitally prosecuted, death sentenced, and executed blacks more than whites. And that's reflected in how jury selection is done in Harris County. The prosecutors in that county routinely exclude African Americans from service on capital juries. So it's really part of an institutional structure in Harris County that discriminates against African Americans.
So if we're talking about racial predispositions that can be proven by the metrics, well, that's one that's real.
Yes, that would be, but that is not the case here. Interestingly enough, the expert who testified to this purported link between race and future dangerousness cited to a researcher who he said is the authority on this subject. The New York Times reached out to that researcher, and he completely refuted it. He said, absolutely no. No one should offer that kind of testimony in a capital case. That is not something that is an accurate predictor of dangerousness. And we know it wasn't an accurate predictor of dangerousness in Mr. Buck's case because we know that for 15 years that this man has been on death row in Texas, he's had not one disciplinary infraction of any kind. And you have to understand, in Texas, you can get a disciplinary infraction for having stamps in your cell. So this is a remarkable evidence of how false the prediction of future dangerousness was.
So what is the timeline for jeopardy to Mr. Buck's life?
We are now in the process of preparing the next appeal on his behalf, and that will be filed imminently. We are waiting to hear what the Harris County District Attorney is going to do. They can allow him and should allow him to exhaust all the appeals that he is legally entitled to pursue, and we are hoping that they will respect the process and allow Mr. Buck to go ahead and do that without seeking an immediate execution date.
In the meantime, you are encouraging activities outside the courtroom.
We are indeed. We have asked folks, actually one of the trial prosecutors in this case, who recognizes the unconstitutionality of what happened here, has launched a change.org petition asking folks to join our call for a new fair sentencing for Dwayne Buck. And so we certainly encourage people to go online and to sign the change.org petition. There is a video on YouTube about Mr. Buck's case. It's called A Broken Promise in Texas. We encourage folks to learn more about the case and learn about the history of racial discrimination in which this case is a part by watching that video on YouTube.
That was Christina Swans of the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund.
Hundreds gathered in Washington to explore the legal, political, military, and moral ramifications of U.S. drone warfare. Among them, Dr. Cornel West of Union Theological Seminary.
This is a historic moment because we want our fellow citizens to know that there is a cloud of witnesses that say that those innocent persons, especially the precious babies who are killed by U.S. drones in Pakistan, in Somalia, in Yemen, have exactly the same value as those priceless white children who were killed in Newtown, Connecticut, as those black brothers and sisters. Sisters on reservations, y'all brothers and sisters, we are here to bear witness and to say that we will not allow the kind of callousness toward catastrophe and indifference to criminality to become the norm and routine in America. That said, it's time to straighten your back up. It's time for us to try to awake our fellow citizens. No more sleepwalking in America when it comes to militarism, when it comes to consumer market-driven materialism, when it comes to racism, anti-Semitism, anti-Arab hatred, anti-Muslim hatred, homophobia, any form of xenophobia, but most importantly, when it comes to imperial crimes. I want to begin with an epigraph from the great W.B. Du Bois. You all know the great Du Bois. Oh, that towering intellectual, that great freedom fighter. He was 89 years old. He began with a trilogy, three novels. 6 years after, he had been handcuffed in a courtroom. 1951, February 51. Why was he handcuffed? Because he was willing to stand up and say, America, you have become not just a full-fledged empire, but you're turning your back on so many of the precious wretched of the earth. To use the language of France, but no. Well, in 1957, page 275 of his novel, The Ordeal of Mansart, he raised four questions that we will be wrestling with today and tomorrow. The first, how does integrity face oppression? Not talking about ideology and politics yet. We're talking about integrity. What kind of human being do you want to be? What kind of nation do we want to be? What kind of species are we in process of shaping? The second question, what does honesty do in the face of defection? There's a whole lot of mendacity going on. There's a lot of wickedness taking place in terms of these immoral and unjust policies. Third question, what does decency do in the face of insult? Integrity, honesty, decency. And that fourth question, how does virtue meet brute force? Doesn't get any more significant than that. Doesn't get any more profound than that. What kind of integrity, honesty, decency, sense of virtue do we want as persons in our own brief trek from mama's womb to tomb? This is a personal question, an individual decision. But then we decide to come together, to coalesce, to organize, to mobilize, to say in the name of our quest, our fallible quest for integrity, honesty, decency, and virtue, we want to tell the truth, and the condition of truth is to allow suffering to speak at every corner of the globe. All right. This is a love movement. We love our brothers and sisters in Pakistan. We love our brothers and sisters in Africa. We love our brothers and sisters in Somalia. We love our brothers and sisters working in the West Bank and Tel Aviv. We love our brothers and sisters in Ethiopia, Guatemala too. That's not just rhetoric and me. You got to do something. You got to be on the move, on the ground, because justice is what love looks like in public, just like tenderness is what love feels like in private. We are honest with ourselves. We have to acknowledge that the dominant tendency of our neoliberal capitalist society is pushing us toward authoritarian, soft, fascist regime. Let's just be honest about it. First tendency, financializing, the financialization of our economy. There's a connection between the military-industrial complex and the oligarchy complex of Wall Street. And the prison-industrial complex affecting so many of our precious poor black and brown brothers. And the cultural multiplex that connects Hollywood and cable news. So we get such a truncated, narrow political discourse that we have to choose between a far-right, mean-spirited, cold-hearted Republican Party and a milquetoast, spineless neo-liberal. Working people. This is not a matter of political correctness. This is a matter of choosing to be a certain kind of human being, willing to organize and mobilize with others who are making that choice to at least keep alive some beacon of hope in a world of such bleakness for so many of our precious brothers and sisters around the world. That financializing. 43% of profits now go to big banks. They produce no products, just deals. Big money in private pockets. And then the privatizing, that second tendency. Any public space, public education, privatize it. Make profit. Public prisons, privatize it. Our public conversation so weak, so feeble, it's been so privatized, polarized, no civility left, very little sense of entering public space without humiliation in order to try to get a sense of what the realities actually are. So we end up with escalating levels of not just mendacity, but ignorance. I didn't say stupidity, because all of us have formed of ignorance. Taught in Ivy League for many years, and I've seen various species of learned ignorance. Not all of them. They all have their limitations. But when you connect the financializing of the economy and the privatizing of our society with the militarizing, domestic front and on the international front, schools in hoods, militarized, going through security, the precious young ones, as they dodge bullets, dealing with massive unemployment, disgraceful housing, decrepit education. And then they get there, there's no arts programs to pique their imaginations. The rich kids get taught, the poor kids get tested. Military-industrial complex, subsidizing a Wall Street with $85 trillion a month going to banks with nearly zero interest rates. Wouldn't it be nice for our students to have the same interest rates as the banks? This is a way into understanding our neoliberal capitalist economy, which is global. That's why it's so good to have our brothers and sisters from Europe, from Asia, from Africa, and other places. Why? Because in the end, we're talking about an international wave of moral awakening, of political escalation that puts a stress on public interest that highlights the weak and vulnerable, be they children, elderly, workers, peoples of color, gay brothers, lesbian sisters, all those persecuted, maybe religious persecution. But behind Iran, there could be ideological persecution. What's going on in Russia? Pussy riot, sisters. And of course, the great William Lloyd Garrison's of our day, the Edward Snowden's. Yeah. Unveiling the lies and the war crimes of our government. They said, oh, Brother West, why do you have to use the word crime? Criminality. Absolutely, we got to tell the truth. I come from a people, the black people, who've been criminalized in perception and in practice for almost 300 and some years. And yet in the face of this being criminalized, in the face of being terrorized, traumatized, and stigmatized, who do? We dish out the John Coltrane, who the love supreme. Yeah. We dish out James Baldwin. We dish out Martin Luther King Jr. We dish out Toni Morrison. Meaning what? In the face of the killing of innocent peoples like U.S. drones, we don't respond with the same hatred. We don't respond with the same counter-terrorism. We decide to take a higher moral and spiritual ground, not because we're naive, but rather because we hold on to our quest for integrity, honesty, decency, and a sense of virtue. And even if at the moment we'd rather be relatively defeated and momentarily defeated now, holding on to our integrity, decency, honesty, and virtue, than win and be with the gangsters. and the thugs, while might makes right, thinking they can get away with anything with no transparency, no accountability whatsoever, turning their back as if somehow the tortured under the Bush administration, no accountability. The wiretappers, no accountability. Wall Street executives, not one going to jail, but oh my God. Let Letitia Jamal get caught with a crack bag on the corner and go to jail for years. What a warped criminal justice system. And yet, let's be very honest about it. We're cutting radically against the grain. We live in a market culture obsessed with the culture superficial spectacle. Where people are so obsessed with narrow conceptions of success, where success is just material toys and position and well-adjusted to injustice and well-adapted to indifference to the suffering of the weak and vulnerable. Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel was right when he said indifference to evil is more evil than evil itself. It becomes a way of life, a mode of being in the world. You just keep walking and turning your back, and your conscience is so coarsened, and your heart is so ardent, your soul becomes so chilly that you end up a hollow and a shallow human being, no matter how many material toys you have, no matter what status you have. And this is true especially for our professional class. That it becomes so well-adjusted to injustice. It's just a matter of peacock-like presence. Look at me. Look at me. My achievements. So we want to see your fruits, not your foliage. You tell the truth and bear witness to justice, not your superficial stature. And this is an issue because there's no way 35 years ago the drones would be dropping on innocent people without the Daniel Ellsbergs and others raising up. Without speeches of Malcolm X on the comment, and Ella Baker, and Fannie Lou Hamer, and Tom Haight, and Stokely Carmichael, Bob Dylan, and Gil Scott-Heron singing the songs. Where are the voices? I come from a tradition that says, lift every voice. I don't say lift every echo. We're so obsessed with success that we don't want to tell the truth. You got to lift your voice when you're talking about drones, not echo the mainstream discourse. Fox News, right wing, MSNBC, neoliberal, both of them so radically inadequate. But we're telling the truth about the connections of the oligarchs and the plutocrats in the White House and in Congress with lobbyists. Don't want to tell the truth about hiding and concealing what is going on in the military-industrial complex. What is AFRICOM? Why is the terrorism shifting to Africa now? Why are the drones shifting to Africa now? Let's tell the story of Lockheed. Let's tell the story of how, in fact, public space is so contracting and emptying out and becoming evacuated that the only option for some of us is more and more hit the streets and go to jail.
Yeah.
That can't be wrong. We want our fellow citizens to know that if they straighten their backs up, if they begin to raise their voices, not just echo the mainstream, and they have the courage to become originals rather than just copies that imitate the mainstream discourse, we might be able to turn this nation around. And turning this nation around is connecting with others, other parts of the world that target that connection to the neoliberal capitalism, increasing wealth inequality, paralyzed political process of government, and a culture that is more and more so superficial, so afraid of speaking the truth, locked into forms of denial. You're going to reap what you sow. You can't drop drones on innocent people, especially innocent children, and think somehow that that does not affect your soul, your destiny, your sense of who you are as a people, let alone who you are as a fragile experiment in democracy, given that imperial weight and burden that's snuffing out the energies of so much of the democratic practices in our society. So I am humbled to be here. I'm blessed to be here. And we want the world to know that this is just the beginning. We are in it for the long run.
Dr. Cornel West at the Drone Summit in Washington, D.C.
The city of Seattle and the state of Washington will swear in a socialist councilwoman this January. Shama Sawant of the Socialist Alternative Party drew national attention in her uphill win against an entrenched Democratic Party machinery. She talks about the larger implications of her victory.
It represents the embryonic beginnings of what could potentially be a triumph over capital. It has a long way to go. We have a long way to go as working people, as people who don't benefit from the system, as the left that is trying to build its forces. But there is no doubt this is a truly historic event. This is absolutely earth-shattering. It's a political earthquake, and I hope that our success here highlights to everybody, not only in Seattle, but nationally and internationally, that the times are changing, that people are looking for alternatives. And if we don't build the forces of the left, and if we don't build mass movements for the needs of working people and for having a sustainable environment, then when would we do it? I hope that people see this campaign's success as a rallying cry to urgently get into the nuts and bolts of building mass movements.
We see even a corporate media arm like the LA Times saying that Seattle now finally has a two-party city council.
Yes, and I think the reason corporate media are paying attention to this race is because they also correctly recognize that this is an event that has political implications well beyond the Seattle City Council. And in fact, another illustration of that is the article that was published on the blog on Forbes.com. You know, Forbes, in fact, calls itself a tool of capital or something like that, a tool of capitalism. It was a poorly written, but a polemic nonetheless against the idea that socialists could be taken seriously. But what's funny about it is that it's being written exactly at the moment that socialists are being taken seriously, and that should show people that working people everywhere, young people, the elderly, the disabled, everyone, people of color, everyone who's shut out of the political debate and recognizes that there is a deep dysfunction in our society and it's not working for us, they are opening their eyes and seeing this as hopefully the opening of a door to bigger events.
And yet some might say that this is only a peculiar Seattle phenomenon.
Yeah, I've heard that. I see a furious discussion on Facebook and other social media about it. And, you know, of course there are unique features to any political event, anywhere. You know, there will be something unique about Seattle. There will be something unique about New York City and Chicago and so on. But regardless, the fact that the majority of the people in the United States are unable to meet their daily needs merely as human beings in the wealthiest country in the world, that exists everywhere. It's not unique to Seattle. The fact that we have a proliferation of low-wage jobs, the fact that there's an epidemic of foreclosures and evictions, the fact that young people especially are struggling to gain even a foothold in terms of getting a, you know, modicum of a standard of living. Large numbers of elderly people have lost their retirement through the financial collapse, while the big banks that were the very causes of the financial collapse are being rewarded in historically high ways. Look at the political dysfunction nationally. The federal government shut down the NSA spy scandal, the way Bradley Manning is being treated, the saber rattling at Syria, the failures of the Obama administration on health care, to deliver any kind of real outcomes for real working people. The fact that only insurance companies and pharmaceutical company executives were invited to the table to discuss healthcare and all single-payer advocates were shut out from the room, what does this show to people? People are understanding that it's not working for us. It's working for the super wealthy and the biggest corporations. It's not working for us, and it is suddenly not in any way addressing the urgent questions of climate change.
Some people would describe that as the crisis of capitalism.
That is absolutely the crisis of capitalism. Capitalism is the underlying reason why we are not able to find solutions for these things. I mean, if you look at the amount of money that is needed to address the immediate problems of poverty, malnutrition, access to good quality education, access to good quality healthcare, safe housing, you know, libraries, parks, all the things that people dream of, and all the things that you would include in any basic vision of what human existence should look like or what a community should look like, all of this is completely possible, and it does not need vast amounts of money. But it's not happening under capitalism. Capitalism has proven itself to be a spectacular failure in meeting some of the most basic needs, and the same goes for the environment. I mean, the science is pretty clear. In fact, I wanted to mention a brilliant article by Naomi Klein recently in the New Statesman, in which she presents her report from having interviewed several leading climate scientists around the world who are themselves saying that it is clear from their science, their scientific results indicate that it is time to have a completely new economic paradigm, because there is no way that a shift from fossil fuels is possible on the basis of capitalism.
Yes, and that the multitude of problems that humanity faces cannot be solved except under socialism.
Absolutely. And what is socialism? I'm sure your listeners would wonder, what does that mean to different people? And what we mean by that is a society which has the ability to democratically govern itself in terms of decision-making on how resources are used, what resources are used, and what they're used for, and how much of it is to be used. So let's take concrete examples. If you ask the average man or woman or child on the street, do you think that wars are a good thing? Do you think the fact that there is so much bloodshed and maiming and destruction, invasions, is a good thing? What answer would you get? Obviously, people are going to say, no, I find that horrendous. I mean, as a human being, I find it unthinkable. But yet, there is endless loss of life, bloodshed, and destruction all around the world. You know, a lot of it instigated by the U.S. regime, but, you know, in general, from the way capitalism works and imperialism works. So why is it that if you ask any ordinary person, most or all of them are going to be really opposed to war and destruction, and yet you have continual and endless wars? That shows you that there is a deep chasm between what the majority of human beings want and what is actually implemented in the system. And what that chasm represents is the fact that we don't have the real power to make decisions in our hands democratically, you know, as the majority. So we don't get to decide that, no, these resources are not going to be deployed to destroy another people or another culture, but we will instead use it to ensure that everybody, everywhere has running water, access to clean water, access to safe food sources, access to good quality housing, planned neighborhoods, clean environment, and so on, and education. This is what people want. People are struggling for their day-to-day needs, but despite everything that they want, they are not able to have any impact on what happens in the system. That's capitalism. Socialism is a way of organizing society where we get to actually decide what we're going to do with the resources.
Let's talk about what's happening in the system, specifically in Seattle. As you are coming in, Boeing Aircraft, a major employer in the area, is threatening to leave.
Yes. If you look at what's happening, Boeing just got a $9 billion handout from the state legislature And they're threatening to move their jobs to another state unless Boeing workers give in to their demands, which is taking major cuts in their pensions, in their health care, and accepting freezes on future wage increases. And the Boeing workers in the union has correctly, with large majority, rejected, because that is not a deal. That is not a negotiation. That is highway robbery. And our question has been, you know, the state legislature, who are these people? The governor is a Democrat. The state house has a Democratic majority. The Senate has a strong Democratic caucus. And yet, overwhelmingly, the state legislature voted to give Boeing executives this handout while telling the rest of us that there is no money in the state treasury to ensure that all the cuts to transit and education and social services can be stopped. And the question we should be asking is, when was the last time the state legislature called a special session to pass this Boeing handout? When was the last time they called a special session to end homelessness or to ensure full funding for public education? It shows you in the clear light of day, you can see that the priorities of the two big business parties are towards big business. They're making their priorities very clear. We are the ones who have to take off the blinders from our eyes and understand that the two-party system is not working for us. I mean, another really beautiful example, Obama recently spoke at a Wall Street Journal CEO council. I mean, the very fact that the president goes and addresses a CEO council should tell us where his priorities lie. But he said something to the effect that, you know, people call me a socialist. I am no socialist. You have to meet a real socialist. I am for lowering corporate tax rates. I stood by a healthcare system that helps corporations. He could not be more honest. You know, let's take Obama at his own words. He is being very candid. He is telling you, I am not on the side of the people. I am on the side of corporations. So it's up to us to recognize that we need to build a mass political alternative to the two parties.
President Obama famously speaks of the genius of the capitalist system.
Yes, the genius that ensures that the wealthy get even wealthier and the rest of us are pushed lower and lower, and many of us below the poverty line.
What's your first order of legislative business once you take your seat?
Our first order of business is to work on the $15 an hour demand in Seattle. I'm sure your listeners have probably heard that $15 an hour initiative passed in SeaTac, which is a neighboring city, and it's going to benefit airport workers. And so there is a lot of momentum on the ground to push for $15 an hour in Seattle, and that will be a major feat, because if we can do it here, then I have no doubt that it will inspire working people in other cities to do it. Because fast food workers have put out this call for 15 and a union. So, you know, we want to push for that in 2014.
That was Seattle City Councilwoman-elect Shama Sawant.
Advertising will soon be posted on city buses in Washington, D.C., featuring a big thank you for whistleblower Edward Snowden. The ad campaign is sponsored by the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund, a public interest legal organization. Mara Verheiden-Hill is the fund's director. She explains why thank yous are in order.
Well, Edward Snowden, at great personal risk, has revealed to the people of the United States and the people of the world this mass surveillance operation that's being conducted by the United States government, really specifically the military, because the NSA is an arm of the Pentagon. And while he's done this, there's been a huge effort from the establishment in Washington, from the politicians, from Congress, to demonize him, when in fact what he's done is heroic. And this is an opportunity to reflect the sentiment of so many people in the United States who feel very strongly supportive of what he's done, grateful about what he's done.
You say you're about to roll out this campaign. Did you get any resistance from the D.C. bus company?
Well, the D.C. bus company can't really do anything about it because there's a constitutional obligation, because it's a quasi-governmental authority. So regardless of whether they agree or disagree with the ads are running.
And you see this as a kind of thumb in the eye to the politicians on Capitol Hill who call Edward Snowden a traitor and other names.
Yes, the fact is that the politicians on Capitol Hill who've tried to demonize Edward Snowden, who've called him a traitor, those people all took an oath to uphold the Constitution. His revelations have called into question whether or not they've been actually doing that, given the fact that they've been authorizing these secret programs. They know about these programs, and many of them have been authorizing them. And, you know, I think we can all agree that if those politicians had said to their constituency, this is what I'm doing, I'm authorizing these programs, that your government is going to be spying on you and collecting data on your emails, your communications, your associations, your transactions, now vote for me, no one would have voted for them. So they've tried to turn this around and attack him, but what Edward Snowden has done is he's ignited a debate that has to happen in the United States. And historically, when the people of the United States learn about government action that's been kept secret, government action that they oppose, they have the ability to mobilize and to change the course.
Not too many weeks ago, a measure that would have defunded at least some of NASA's spying on Americans lost a vote in Congress by only 7 votes.
It's true, and it really shows sort of how beholden all the politicians are and how subservient most of them are to these government agencies, to the intelligence agencies, to the military, how difficult it is for them or how unwilling they are to stand up and speak out, and really, frankly, how much more heroic Edward Snowden is than these politicians. But at the same time, it shows, you know, that they're getting calls from their constituents. And the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund, in addition to this project, has organized grassroots around the country who have been contacting Congress, contacting elected officials, and telling them they want them to end the bulk surveillance programs. And we can see that there are thousands of people who have been participating in these activities.
We note that 14 black members of Congress, members of the Congressional Black Caucus, voted in favor of the NSA. You would think that that type of constituency would be most opposed to government spying on citizens.
I would certainly think that anyone with a historical knowledge of the U.S. government's spying operations, of COINTELPRO, of Operation Chaos, of other types of activities would recognize this for what it is. And this is not programs where, you know, they're claiming that they're rooting out terrorism. I mean, they are collecting data on people that is regardless of any suspicion of criminal or illegal activity, in fact, in the absence of any suspicion whatsoever. And these type of programs are used as tools of social and political control. And that's what this is. We should make no mistake about what these programs are and what their purpose is. And if there is going to be any effort to, you know, the idea that we live in a democracy, you can't have the basic format of a democracy when you have a government that is collecting complete data on each one of us that allows them to create, at a moment's notice, pull everything together, have a very detailed personal profile on our lives, our thoughts, our associations, our activities. That's a very dangerous thing for the government to be able to do.
Recently, you've received information from the NSA that you demanded about the state's interference in and observations of and spying on the Occupy movement.
We have a major government transparency program here at the PCJF where we have demanded from the government free information, public records, access to documents, and have fought to pull out from different U.S. intelligence agencies information on their spying, surveillance, and disruption activities in the United States. So, for example, over the past year, we exposed and uncovered that the FBI, Department of Homeland Security, and other intelligence agencies were engaged in using their anti-terrorism authority and their anti-criminal authority against the peaceful Occupy movement, which they expressly acknowledged was peaceful, that they were using their funding, those authorities, to engage in surveillance operations, to be involved in coordination with the police department and the crackdowns across the United States. And we're also currently fighting to get material out from the NSA, from Department of Homeland Security, from the Department of Justice, from FBI, related to these bulk surveillance programs that Edward Snowden has revealed. In the past week, we've received more documents from the NSA in response to that, but we recognize that the documents that they're releasing at this point are very self-selected, self-serving We believe it's critical that we be able, and others in the United States are able, to really see the scope of what these surveillance operations are. We're entitled to know what they're doing and how they're doing it so that we can challenge it. So I would urge people to go to thankyouedsnowden.org, where they can get involved, they can get engaged in this, they can use some of the online mechanisms to tell Congress to oppose the bulk surveillance programs, and they can also support these efforts to raise awareness as well as thank Ed Snowden for what he's done.
Mara Verheiden-Hill, speaking from Washington.
Also in the nation's capital, the Center for Corporate Policy has just released a new report on corporate spying. It's titled Spooky Business, Corporate Espionage Against Nonprofit Organizations. Gary Ruskin is the center's director and an author of the report. We ask Ruskin, why would private corporations spy on activist groups?
The main reason is that nonprofit organizations can, in many ways, do a lot of damage to corporations' bottom line and to perhaps their most valuable asset, which is the value of their brand. If a nonprofit organization exposes wrongdoing or anything wrong that the company does, that can cause tremendous fallout for a corporation. And so many corporations are quite nervous about what lots of nonprofits are doing, and so increasingly we see corporate espionage against nonprofit organizations.
And to get the resources, the human resources for this espionage, they go to the professionals.
That is the truth. One of the interesting things about corporate espionage against nonprofit organizations these days is it's some of it is very, very professionalized. It's conducted by subcontractors and contractors who may be former members of the NSA, FBI, CIA, U.S. military, and other former law enforcement officials, as well as sometimes moonlighting members of local police departments.
Well, if they're using all of these ex-government personnel, certainly the government, the official spies, should be well aware of these corporate activities.
Well, you'd think so, and we assume that's true. I mean, given how many major companies have been involved in corporate espionage, either planned or executed against nonprofit organizations, companies like Walmart, Monsanto, Bank of America, Dow Chemical, Kraft, Coca-Cola, Burger King, McDonald's, Chevron, Shell, BP, and on and on, you would think they would be aware of this, and I'm sure many are. It's just that to date there has been very little in the way of investigation or prosecution when there is illegal, apparently illegal, espionage conducted against nonprofits.
I suppose the question is, do you think that this private espionage is sanctioned or even abetted by the state?
Well, we don't really have the faintest idea, but what we will be asking for and we think is very important is that in cases where there is potential wrongdoing, possible illegality, the Justice Department ought to investigate, and we hope they will do that.
We can understand, the layperson can understand, why Dow Chemical and Monsanto might be leery of having their corporate activities made public, but what do McDonald's and Burger King have to fear from nonprofits?
Well, the Burger King story was basically that they targeted a great nonprofit organization called the Coalition for Immokalee Workers down in Florida, a heroic organization that works on behalf of mostly tomato pickers in Florida. And so Burger King sicked the spies on them. McDonald's is a very old story. It has to do with espionage that was conducted in London a very long time ago against some activists who were calling attention to a wide variety of McDonald's activities back in the 1990s.
And just as the range of corporations that mount spy activities against nonprofits is a broad one, the range of targets is pretty broad, too, from environmental groups to animal rights and almost everything in between.
Yeah, it is so broad. I mean, we're talking, you know, environmental anti-war, public interest, consumer groups, food safety groups, pesticide groups, nursing home reform, gun control, social justice. And part of the point of the report is, I bet many of the listeners to this fine show, work in some of these organizations. And so we just want you to know about the types of tactics that may be deployed against you so that you can be prepared so that you can try to defend against such tactics.
What are those tactics? You say that some of them are unethical or illegal. Like what?
Well, the report documents a really very wide range of espionage tactics against nonprofits. But to try to do it briefly, so there's human intelligence gathering, which is typically a corporation will hire a staffer who will then go and pose as a volunteer or as a journalist and impersonate them, and they will gather information that way. Then there's physical intelligence gathering, which can be done a wide variety of ways, but the way that we found most often was dumpster diving. So they will get access to a dumpster. For example, in a famous Greenpeace case in Washington, D.C., a company called BBI used an active duty police officer to access Greenpeace dumpsters, I think it was 55 times. And so they'll obtain documents that way and review them. And then there's electronic espionage, which there are many different forms of electronic espionage. We could talk about that for a very long time, but some common ways are doing vulnerability research. There are a wide variety of computer hacking techniques that can be used, obtaining phone records, wiretaps, phone voicemail hacking. Those are a few ways.
And which of those ways are illegal, cut and dried illegal?
Well, for example, with the dumpster diving, you know, if you're trespassing on somebody's property to obtain their garbage, well, that certainly seems to be trespass. Things like a wide variety of hacking and wiretapping is certainly illegal as well.
If these professionals working for corporations are often policemen as well as former CIA and NSA, what good does it do to call the law? Should one call the law?
I think so. I mean, I think that we have to make a case to the Justice Department that this is a significant matter of concern. And so we ask people to report this and to corporate espionage against nonprofits when it's illegal and to tell us about it, too, so that we can help make sure that justice is done.
Snitch on the spooks.
Yes, absolutely, because we're supposed to have a rule of law in this country, and so let's make it happen.
That was Gary Ruskin, Center for Corporate Policy. The town of Benton Harbor, Michigan, like all of the state's largely black cities, is under the dictatorship of an emergency financial manager appointed by the state. The rationale is that Benton Harbor and the other black population centers don't know how to handle their fiscal affairs. But local activist leader Reverend Edward Pickney says the real problem is the domination of the town by the giant Whirlpool Corporation. Benton Harbor has been forced to borrow millions of dollars a year, but Reverend Pickney says Whirlpool pays no taxes at all.
Don't pay any taxes, or do they pay a water bill? See, they get water free, not only for their corporate headquarters, but also they have a golf course here, the Jack Nicklaus Signature Golf Course. They pay no water at all, no water bill, which runs up into the hundreds of thousands if they pay. They don't pay anything. And here's the word, the language they use. If you say something, we'll move. You just built a new corporate headquarters here. You are not moving out of Benton Harbor.
So here we have Benton Harbor, one of the many mostly black cities and towns in Michigan in which residents do not have an effective vote because an emergency financial manager has been imposed by the state to run their affairs. And here you have the dominant economic power in town not even paying taxes.
Absolutely. And they have no intention of doing anything to help this black community.
And now Benton Harbor has to figure out other ways to raise money other than taxing the biggest company in town. They want you to borrow money, in fact, don't they?
Absolutely. But before that, we had put an income tax on the table and put it on the ballot. And 95% of the people that worked in Benton Harbor do not live here. So our goal was to tax them. And we were going to accumulate $3.5 million, not one year, but every year. And what they did, Whirlpool flooded the community with dollars, close to $100,000, to make sure that did not pass in our community.
So all these Whirlpool executives and even white-collar workers who live in other places wouldn't have to pay a dime for the upkeep of Benton Harbor.
Absolutely, and that was the main target because Jeff Fettig, the CEO and president of Whirlpool, makes around about $25 million a year. He would have had to leave some of that money here in the city of Benton Harbor, and that's why they was fighting so hard. Because Whirlpool have always been in control for the last 25 years.
So you want Benton Harbor to actually be self-sustaining and self-sufficient, but you've got Whirlpool on your back.
And Whirlpool definitely do not want the city of Benton Harbor to be self-sufficient and able to do whatever they need to do. They want us to be dependent on them. And usually that's the way society is now. They want black people to depend on white people for everything that you want to have.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. And while you're there, check out the latest episode of Black Agenda Television. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the black left. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Melissa Gerson.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.